point, I noticed that Sean Bean was getting killed a lot, so I thought I should write a poem called The Death of Sean Bean. After I wrote the poem, a friend of mine sent me a YouTube link, and he dies. He's killed 22 times. The video was the 22 times edited together. And the top rated comment kind of sums the poem up. The top rated comment was, "Stop killing Sean Bean," which I enjoyed a lot. The death of Sean Bean. Today, you'll go to the cinema, leave at a loss to explain why you live in a world where, even in a movie, Sean Bean always dies. Like last time, all the heroic promise insinuated by a few generous, never overblown moments snuffed out to leave you disillusioned in a state of existential crisis. You'll leave the hall and know once more, a collective knowing silently shared by everyone filing towards the exits, that the world doesn't make sense. That is the import of Sean Bean's scripted death. Make no mistake about that. Knowing that the world is a place where the Sean Beans don't live, not anymore anyway, if they ever did. And knowing that they should, that the Sean Beans of the world should always be its future. On that silver screen of your dreams, he does the impossible with seeming ease. The outrageous unthinkable, the world with sense thing, defies the script at every turn with his brilliant survival. There, his pocket edition of Yeats always stops the bullet before it kisses flesh. And you know, as the credits play over Sean Bean facing such a beautiful sunset, that everything makes sense for it. All is right with the world, that the sun will rise again many times, that the best days are ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Edward. Next, we have Leanne O'Sullivan.
Thank you. Hopefully I'll be able to remember it. I brought one to read, but it's not actually there yet, which happens too. So if I forget some of this, it's part of the performance. It's called At Grands, which is a place on the Bear Peninsula where I'm from, and it's in the voice of the watchman from Agamemnon, the play Agamemnon. The watchman says, "Now I wait for the light, for the signal fire," and just that notion of watching out. So, O Lord, grant me tonight my clearest sight, and compass my watch with a steady eye, for fear I dream I'd swept away this time. I saw the bright millstone lower against the sea, and the stars telling our fortunes in a gaining wind, friends who've fallen on the way, ambition, envy, too much dreaming. How shall I keep staying? In the middle of the longest night, I woke trembling on the staff of my elbows, but recognized enough to make my living real. Foothold in the earth, my grove against the currents and those cold martello fires, our great silent heralds of the sky. Nothing happened but the dark, the skin of the dark repeating, shake yourself, sentry, look alive.
Thank you. And next we have Donal Maloney.
This is a short story. It's quite a short story, but it'll probably been too long to finish it. It's when I'm not... I'll try and find a good place that it makes sense to stop. I'm not sure I'll find it.
I say we squeeze it in.
Okay. Yeah. It's called And Now This. My dinner cooked and ready to eat. What was I doing answering the door? I wouldn't normally be that stupid, but I was feeling strange that day. The Ryan report was out, and the airwaves were full of the evil. And now it was all out and acknowledged, it felt, I don't know, I'm too embarrassed to say. I left my lamb chop to cool in the pan and went to answer it. The bell rang again as I was kicking a chunk of wood under the door of my flat. That's important because of the draft. I forgot once and it slammed shut and the glass shattered. The landlord paid for a new pane, but it took him weeks to fix it. By the time I made it down the hall and opened the front door of the house, the man was already halfway down the steps. He turned back and smiled at me. "How are you today?" he said in an African accent that dragged out the word "are" and said "you today" like it was one word. It took me a while to work out what he'd said. The right sleeve of his jacket breathed in and out as he walked up the steps to me. In his left hand he was carrying a magazine. "I'm fine," I said in answer to his question. There was anger in my voice. I don't know how to explain how disappointed I was. It was like a boy who was told he was getting a present for his birthday, and it turns out to be a shirt he had the use of anyway. But why was I disappointed? Who cares if there's a Jehovah or something at the door? What was I expecting? "When was the last time you prayed?" he asked. He wasn't messing around. Weren't they meant to sweeten you up with some chit-chat first? "That's a personal question," I said. "I'm not telling you that." A voice floated out of my flat and then the hall to us. It was about how a boy was stripped naked and mocked and kicked all over the floor by three brothers. It sounded unreal in the presenter's smooth voice. The whole morning had been unreal, all these stories falling out of the radio. Later, two of the brothers took turns to rape the boy. I felt shy about this coming out of my flat and onto the street. I didn't like this stranger opposite me hearing it. "Is the love of God in your heart?" said the Jehovah. The way he said "heart" was more like breathing than talking. Trying to understand him was hurting my head. I looked closer at his face and saw that he was younger than I thought first. It might have been the suit that made him think he was older. I was minded to go easy on him, he was probably a beginner. But the question he asked me, it was too hard. "Is the love of God in your heart?" How can you ask a stranger something like that? "That's even more personal," I said. "You can hardly get more personal." "All the time," said a different voice on the radio. I was afraid all the time. Tried to make myself small so I wouldn't be noticed. It was a rough voice, like the one I heard come out of my mouth sometimes at the welfare, half the time almost disappearing, and the other half almost shouting. "But that didn't save you, did it?" said the presenter. His voice was all over the place, and the seriousness he was trying to put on kept slipping off. That's the way it sounded to me, anyway. "Are you a believer?" asked the Jehovah. Was he dense or what? He didn't have a clue how to talk to people. I'm lonely enough, you know. I should be easy meat for people like him. Once I bought perfume soap off a saleswoman who came here, just because she asked me how I was and buttered me up. You respect people like that. She smelled nice too, which is good for selling soap. "There's no point to this," I said. "You'll find more fertile ground on other doorsteps." Was that from the Bible, the fertile ground bit? In any case, it encouraged him. He asked me why I was not fertile ground. How was I meant to answer that? "When I left that place, I could barely spell my name," said the voice on the radio. "Have you closed your heart?" said the Jehovah. Couldn't he hear the radio? It was scalding my ears. "I didn't even know I could do anything," continued the man on the radio. "Every time I knew beforehand when he was going to abuse me. I knew beforehand because he would start saying that nobody loved me. All that coming from my flat. It felt like my clothes had been whipped off and I was standing there in the nip. Did you hear that?" I asked the Jehovah. "It mightn't mean anything to you where you're from, but those children, did you hear about that? Those children were left to suffer. Do me a favour and make sense of that for me. Make sense of that and I'll convert right here and now. You hear me?" "God heals all hurt," he said, and made a circle with his arm on the word "all." The fear in his eyes made him look even younger. As frightened as he was, though, he stood his ground. "What do you know about anything?" I shouted. How old are you? "I'm 23," he said, "and I know things." "And what about my question, then? Why did those children have to suffer?" He looked at me in the eye and took a step up towards me. Now that he was on the same level, I saw how tall he was. If you say it's a mystery, I swear I'll... I noticed I had him by the scruff. I'm not sure when that happened. "Get your hands off," he said in a soft, determined voice. "Convert me," I said into his face. "What did you come knocking round for? Here's your chance. Convert me now." "In our congregation." "Cult," I said. "It's not a cult," he insisted. "What's your name?" I asked. I was in a flow and there was no stopping me. "Tio," he said. "Well, I'll rescue you, Tio. Rescue you from your cult. Just tell me where those children had to suffer." As soon as I said this, it wasn't enough for me. "Undo it," I said. "Make it okay again." I shook him and one of his shirt buttons popped off and hit me on the nose. "You're crazy," he shouted. "Let go, crazy man." A woman pushing a pram stared over as she scuttled by. I said, undo it, and I'll make your arm grow back. I can do it, I'm a fucking healer. Ask anyone, I swear I'll make your fucking arm grow back. He dropped his magazine and grabbed me by the throat. The fucker nearly pushed me Adam's apple out the other side of my neck. If I knew what was good for me, I would have stopped there, but the anger and spite were all over me. "What happened, your arm?" I grunted. "Machete," he whispered. "I lost my arm when rebels raped my mother. I tried to stop them." He pulled me right up close to his face and I could see the tiny stubble on his jaw. His breath smelled like the inside of a bakery. "They raped her and they killed her, and my sister too. My little sister, she..." A sound came out of his throat that was like hard plastic cracking. "I loved my little sister," he said finally. He tightened his clutch around my neck and I gasped for air. He looked me full in the eyes. "And then, when they had killed them, then they raped me with their rifles." He knotted me and shoved me into the hall. And in my darkness, our Lord held me. The heavy door swung shut. "Is that enough? Is that an answer for you?" "I'm sorry," I said. "I'm not normally like this." You should have heard the meekness in my voice. It was perfection. The anger went out of him on the spot. I wasn't young anymore and wasn't getting up from a headbutt anytime soon. He knelt down beside me. "You are sorry?" he asked. "I'm sorry." He stroked my forehead. I looked down his shirt at his chest. "That's better," he kept saying. He said "better" as if it rhymed with later. I slumped my arm up around his neck and pulled him down to me. "This is bad," he said. 20 minutes later and he was pulling up his boxers and kneeling beside my bed to pray. Feeling self-conscious, I pulled a sheet over my privates. He bowed his head and I got a proper look at the scars on his shoulders and back. His praying seemed to last for ages. I suppose it was a big sin. I had lots to get straight in my head, but I couldn't think of anything else with him there. When he got back up and lay down beside me, I felt more grateful than I've ever felt in my life. No exaggeration, crossed my heart. "I'm sorry," he said, breathing the O and rolling the earth. "No need to be. This was wrong." Wrong is okay, I thought. He didn't say it was a mistake. I nodded and kept quiet, playing it tough. "Is that your wife?" He pointed at the photo on the wall opposite. "X," I said. "What happened?" "Do you know any easy questions?" I snapped. "I'm thick as it gets, a fucking berserker. All I can do is manage it." "Only teasing," I said now in my softest voice. "Because of this?" he asked. "I drank too much," I said, and left it at that. I didn't want him to know how little of this I'd ever done, and anyway, drinking was reason enough. I asked him if his religion was strict about this. "Religion, mind," I said. He flashed him a smile. I said, "Religion." If he got the joke, he didn't show it. "I don't want to do this," he said. "I want to serve our Lord." He sat up and put his head in his hand. I thought about putting my hand on his back, but the scars put me off. He stood up and got dressed. There was a lot of shuffling and jerking because of the arm. I looked away. "I'll go now," he said. "Wait. If... I don't want to lead you astray, but if you... you can call here." I said that last bit to his back. I listened to the sound of his big shoes flopping through the kitchen and out the flat door. A few seconds later, the vibrations from the house door slamming passed up the wall behind me and rattled my brains through the pillow. I got dressed and went out to the kitchen. One look at the lamb chop and my stomach did something drink had never made it do. I walked in circles around the kitchen and stared at the door. So this was love. 58 years old, and now I knew.
Thanks, Donald, for the short, short story. Next, we have Emily Davis Fletcher.
Thanks. I brought home about Missouri, and that's where I'm from. But I just want to read really fast. A country song, like just two stanzas from a country song that I think pay better tribute to Missouri than my poetry does, and the Hicks at home that listen later on the internet might enjoy it. So this is Brooks and Dunn, it's Red Dirt Road. I was raised off of old Route 3, out past where the blacktop ends. We walked to church on Sunday morning, raced barefoot back to Johnson's fence. That's where I first saw Mary, on that roadside picking blackberries. That summer I turned a corner in my soul, down that red dirt road. It's where I drank my first beer. It's where I found Jesus. Where I wrecked my first car. I tore it all to pieces. I learned the path to heaven is full of sinners and believers. Learned that happiness on earth ain't just for high achievers. I've learned, I've come to know, there's life at both ends of that red dirt road. So, okay, and this is my home about Missouri. Wash house. He blackens the house, TV, cuts the phone, before driving off in his truck, like one long scab, ripping up gravel into the sunset, before Mom can turn inside out. This autumn, leaves fall in pairs. Her brother died in March. Her body hardens around a boy, names people who died of a broken heart. I miss cartoons, watch shadows sharpen along the wall, till she falls silent long enough for fear to pull me down, searching closets and dark slices behind doors. I find her behind the house, walking barefoot in the horseshoe gravel drive, skirt turned up into a bowl sagging, with the weight of rocks above her knees. I step out in socks. The screen door smacks, makes her jump and spill her collection of dead seeds. I brace myself for her curse, or plead to run for help. Instead, she bends to pick the heaviest, then stands, faces the wash house with its rusted roof and scabby door that hangs towards his pigs, slack barn, the sun's hysteric escape through trees. In one quick streak, her right arm makes the window shriek and hold its breath in shock. But what it's become, a gaping mouth bearing jagged teeth. She empties her fist again and again, knocks out each brown tooth as I come closer. The windows lose their voices, and we aim for what we remember locked inside. We beat dust into the air like congested breath, shatter jars of screws chewed down with Indian head pennies, blow open the cracked smiles of China dolls, spill rusted coffee cans of crusted fish hooks, bust balls of burned out Christmas lights, tear spiders from their nets saving losses, stir wasps from their corner nests like pupils fleeing swollen muddy eyes, to take in more light than the scraps thrown over his shoulder as he sits in the doorway once a month, crushing a mountain of beer cans, one husk at a time, sparking the sun's riot of color. Thanks.
Thank you, Emily. Next, we have Cahill Ryder O'Donovan.
I usually have a beard, right now I don't. Guys with beards and long hair tend to get one comment from every single person they pass on the street. And this is about this one specific comment. Perhaps in a certain light, I look like Jesus. Or maybe from a specific angle, there's that messianic je ne sais quoi. Or if I wear my hair just so, I might give that vibe of a man who brought salvation to 10 damn souls before breakfast. Or places where I've been, they've been forgiven for mistaking me for a Nazarene. It's Jesus, they all cry. Blonde Jesus, they qualify. What stands between me and the personification of eternal salvation is peroxide blocks, according to those baptized in this Catholic nation. He's there in every illustration, in every celluloid creation, the Holy Scripture's star attraction, the Son of God's clearly Caucasian. Perhaps in a certain light you just assume I was born and raised in a desert town, or maybe from a specific angle my nose just kind of sort of seemed a bit convex. Maybe Jesus wears contact lenses on his days off. Or maybe I'm just him and his son is just me, the final interventionist miracle of genealogy and geography. Long hair and a beard is all you need to tell you're truly in the presence of Emmanuel. So here I am, finally re-arrived, the incarnation you all recognize. So roll out the red carpet, put my name up in lights. It's your favorite Christ, the white is your light.
Thanks, Jesus. And next we'll have John McNally, the five-way champion.
You're crucifying me. Nightkirk. Though invisible, black on seamless black, betrayed by mechanics. Wood complaining against iron, visible but for an instant. Or as a silverfish flash, then returns, squealing into the darkness.
Thank you, John. I'll keep the mic here. Next up, we have Mary O'Connell.
Thanks, Paul. There does seem to be a theme tonight, sort of religious theme, and this is called West Meets East. Tuesday, 11 o'clock for the break in our boarding school refectory. Mother Joseph poised at the head of the table. Now pass up your cups for the cocoa. Her no-nonsense voice says it all. I whisper, the taste makes me sick. Drink it down, child, and offer it up for the poor holy souls in purgatory. Her flawless logic of self-sacrifice fails to get through my 12-year-old skull. The sisters who taught us were decent and fair. Respect was encouraged, patience revered, consideration for others especially prized. We were not to be boisterous out on the corridors. There was silence at mealtimes and during retreats. They cared for our well-being and gave good advice. Please help out your mothers during the holidays and try and eat fruit instead of our sweets. Now that I'm older, I listen to talks by Buddhists who speak of the power of Tonglen, where to breathe in the pain of another is believed to bring solace to both. Eastern mystics use riding the breath to attain inner stillness, quieten the yammering inside the head. They speak of the need to cultivate mindfulness, try to take steps for the ego to die. The nuns, in their way, looked to share this endurance. The language they used was less abstract and dense. They wished to be modest, truthful, courageous, to give good example, remaining serene. in a world crazed with violence, greed, and deceit, East and West come together on the path of restraint. They both offer wisdom distilled over aeons to open humanity's true way of being. Thank you.
Very spiritual evening altogether, isn't it? After those two Jesuses and a Mary, we can move on, and we'll go on to Charles Clark.
I was in proof in the art. For a number of years, and the title of this is In the Gallery. Hung on the line in the National Gallery of Ireland are a number of paintings from the French 19th century by Theodore Roosevelt Rousseau, one of the men of 1835, Diaz de la Peña, a Protestant, Charles Emile Jacques, painter of sheep, Troyon, painter of cows, and Meissonier, of horses in the snows of Russia, who made himself immensely rich, and which was the cause of Manet's making art a career. Most paintings have a story attached. Here's another tiny one. I was in the gallery one day when a group passed these pictures, and a Frenchman, 30-something, smartly dressed, glanced at the Jacques and said, "Oh, the lovely sheep." He may have even said it in French. It was sarcastic in any case. When you think of it, he had a point. Was poor old Charlemagne reduced to painting sheep, and why? We can dismiss the idea that there was a medical cause or kink. It seems obvious that sheep were fashionable, not to the extent of cows, of course, which have had a long history in Dutch art, and are in any case more valuable in the marketplace. Even our own Nathaniel Hone the Younger did a few picture called Sheep and Linalure, though he had the excuse of becoming a farmer when he inherited 300 acres of Rahini. He also painted cows and yachts, as is well known. Sheep are less thought-provoking, and people who are wealthy enough to buy paintings do not want to have to think, and particularly not when they're at the dinner table. All these paintings came from Chester Beattie, a mining engineer who became very rich indeed and was a very great collector. What an accumulation. He owned manuscripts, prints, snuff bottles, paintings, and much, much more. Giving a lot of it away must have seemed a solution to an old problem. You can't take it away. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Charles. Next, could we welcome Patricia Walsh?
Okay, keeping up with the evening, I'll be mercifully short and mercifully sweet. It's called Anime. It can't be seen how cold it gets if everything is bright outside. A summer dress on a suicide, caked and splashed from wild regrets. Wild regrets and steps untaken, measured coldly, sugar-free. Designed to save not just you but me, not surprised at what we're making. We're making a plot to make you gods, and if you're willing, run to us. At no extra cost, as hard as focus, fancies thick to shield you from all odds. From all odds, the coach is going into nowhere just as planned. Time and space can't ever bore you, nor inflame the longing for dry land. For dry land eats its own young sometime, with staggered mercy now exempt. So cast yourself to green fields further, from belly-bound dust, and be content.
Thanks, Patricia. Next, could we welcome, I think for the first time, Meg Squeedon?
quite a rookie and very bashed trying to make an effort, but I will try. I suppose I have always kept my writing internally, and I just did a little bit of quickly, a little bit of script into our spectre. And this is a story about two little journeys that I came home from.
Sorry,
we're
going to.
Can you hear me? Yeah, it's not going to be very long. Well, no, it's not going to be very long. So that's it. I'm not going to talk to you. Just a journey one and a journey we went in after. The canopy stretched across the canvas frame of Liberty Hill, swept with vivid brush strokes, embossed magenta, peach, coral and flint. Sometimes it's a savage fire and later it quietens, so hazy and tranquil, ever changing and morphing westward, shrinking, sinking still. Its breath is worth a fish island, so wide as this Celtic prairie. The sound of livestock is lowing below the traffic passing this dairy. The valley is bisected by the Onagree's blue bog meander and sheep farm cotton puff filled terraces stacked on the hillside camber. Horses graze on marshy fields, many piebald chestnut and dapple grey, and a hawk hovers, finding his course, takes its bearing from this river's way. The city's haze is deserted and the daily exodus ebbs and flows like the tide, leaving Barrow Hill. Here is their promised land, a vista pilgrims view with pride. And I leave the horror of A&E, 4G to palate cleanse, heart healed with a vision. A rainbow of colour wipes our windscreen clean, refracted through my eyes prism. Of God, my son would say, clouds tower, cirrus switches rearing manes and tails. It's the risky route, work to keep your eyes on the lane unswerved. Our ancestral trail, seaward, railing towards the copper kings we served. Terra firma must outbattle the ceiling's fiery firmament, and I sense monstrance. Fragile mortal coil so far from permanent. It's augmented by crazy swerving and evading on their hard shoulder shove. This is a painful beauty, and like all good installations, lasts a fleeting look above, constantly changing, dissipating forever into the stratosphere. The time I spend on this chocolate task of viewing is a lost leader. I wish I could take just one more minute with this soothing sedator's pill. I turn away to climb such a calvary up the gradient of my break cartoon, and I'm sure it's in there somewhere. I'm moving that. And just So the thought comes to me as I start my eastward climb and eyes resting with a blink. I check my rear view glass. There I think is my sunrise rising, golden rosy pink. One more shot at hourglass upending, to run the grains of time in reverse. One last glimpse to lift my sunrise slowly up again, as I climbed it rose back sky inversed. Emerging back to peep once more with me alone from behind the Donny Hills, it stayed in vision rising with me ever upwards to grant my little miracle. Now I must ensure it will not be the last thing that I see, so riveted I was I climbing up with this optical reality. And landing home, greeted by my beloved colleague Rocky, he shepherds me over the cattle grids up the drive and escorts me. The triumphant entry into Jerusalem but no Hosanna here to see. My berth facing westward is carefully lined by my trusty friend, vigorously barking to ensure all crows are chased away from the airfield. There is his wildest glory, a request granted, savoured rays once more, another golden moment watching western sunset descend on Cork. And I took that little journey home, you know, when he came back to me. And I've been.
Sorry, Max, we won't have time for a second round.
Oh, that's perfect.
Next week, come back then. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Thank you, Max. I do hope you come back. I'm sorry, we are a bit stuck for time, so we have to keep it to one poem per person from here out. And it's Dean Brown next, please, to your point.
Read a wee poem, a song perhaps called The Fall. Remember how that last Thursday before the fall, like two pups, we climbed against the sliding screen up onto the railway slopes, and how I took my little scrip of acorns, chestnuts, bone, and left you there, who would not stop till you'd turned up your own. You were there to stay, though I guessed nothing. Not in slanting rain, how tangled in the lines your lace, how stubbornly you'd remain.
Thank you, Dean. Next to the mic we have Rab Rakat.
In keeping with the religious theme of the evening, this is a Protestant poem. My anger and frustration lead to my self-devaluation, to degradation, lethargy and sloth. By sitting, smoking, thinking, procrastinating and drinking, I get to a place where I don't give a toss. And the only thing I've found to consistently make my world go round is work, practice, effort. Call it what you will, hate, and sometimes it's a bitter pill, but still, work, practice, effort leads to true relaxation instead of sitting around chewing off your fingernails with agitation. Work, practice, effort.
Thanks for those words of wisdom. Next up we have Philip Deptula.
It's told by a person much smarter than me that if I don't know how to title a poem, I would just date it, and that's why it's called July 19th, 2013. We pick the berries under the Interstate 287 bridge and walk to the lazy river and catch the black O's and float on them like the cars on blocks that once had their rebel souls. We built a fire from sparse shade and warmed the earth between us. We watched the sunset and wonder if the green and pink were natural or a century ago. We point out the dimming stars and fall asleep to the rhythmic howls of the tracks above us.
Thanks, Philip. Next I have Niall, is it Harney or no? Marn, is it Hearn? I'm sorry.
It's Hearn.
Hearn, is it?
Yeah,
Niall Hearn.
We are the ones who tore down heaven and put up the gates. We locked out love we once had above. We shot our white doves with our weapons of war and then threw the carcass behind a closed door. Oh, what a fucking bore we have become when to get famous, just act dumb. But you see, but if you see me looking stupid, then trust I'm playing dumb. I'm strumming life's chords while marching to a drum. I want to see the universe in the patterns of my thumb and then give off good vibrations like,
Thank you, Niall. Next, could we call on Lucia Pasquale?
This is called Lucid Dream. In 2 days' time, there will be an apocalyptic crash that will send my things across the room, smashing into walls, crumbling a lifetime to bits. All I see will glow, white and hot. I am counting on this. In the coming days, words such as ordinary will become obsolete. Ordinary as a noun, the stale bread we ate for breakfast this morning. They will be replaced by words that soothe the throat like honey when spoken, that smell like lavender on your fingertips when picked, that fill the gut like a hearty meal when ingested, that satisfy, that effect. I am counting on this. In just a matter of hours, we will become sentimental. We will reminisce about grandmother's leg of lamb, Christmas of 1999. Tender, filling, and fleeting all at once. Pleasure devoured. We will become falcons in hungry pursuit of the past. In the moment that we reach our prey, we will become aware. Our talons will turn to fingertips. Slowly as we spiral towards ground, we will realize we have no wings, just arms dangling clumsy and reluctant at our sides. We cannot fly. We are deathly afraid of heights. We will become lucidly aware. I will be counting on this.
Thank you, Lucia. Just a couple of more people left now. Could we please call Michael Ray to the mic, please?
The Artist's Way. Today, I'm working from the call centre of Culture. My technical assistants are embedding diamonds in a freshly made turd. We are sending pressing press releases to the media explaining how it birthed after I ate the fricasseed penis of a kidnapped paedophile. When the work is finished, you will see its stark beauty positioned within a gilded frame, like the Venetian secret. Bestowing power on such an asset is a soft problem. But I have deep pockets, a cast of respected curators and international collectors, arms dealers, multinationals, and other first world dictators.
Thank you, Michael. And to end the evening tonight, we have Cal Doyle.
Rab doesn't like simulates. Goldfish. The glowing street lamps swam like goldfish in the valley below us. On the horizon, chimneys smoked strings up to the neon-coloured cloud cover. This town can't hold its liquor, you said. Then you took another smoke on your cigarette. You swept your pale fingers to the darkening light, like a young girl through a springtime pond might, to scatter goldfish, perhaps, or her reflection.